This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest's father wrote the lyrics for the national anthem of the late Soviet Union. Andrei Konchalovsky is an emigre film director and a member of an eminent family of Russian artists. His grandfather and great-grandfather were famous painters. His brother Nikita Mikhalkov is an actor and director who's been called the Robert Redford of Russia. As for my guest Andrei Konchalovsky, he was one of Russia's most highly regarded directors. His post-war epic Siberiad was the highest-grossing Russian film ever made. After Siberiad was completed in 1979, he left the country in search of artistic and personal freedom. His wife is French, so he was able to leave Russia to be with her. Konchalovsky has since made several films in the United States, including Shy People and Runaway Train. He returned to Russia to make his new film, The Inner Circle. It's based on the true story of Stalin's film projectionist. It stars Tom Hulce as the projectionist and Bob Hoskins as the head of the KGB. This was the first major motion picture filmed inside the Kremlin and the KGB headquarters. Before we spoke about his new film, Konchalovsky told me how he feels about the end of the Soviet Union.
I feel very good about the end of the Soviet Union because nothing can be worse than the system that doesn't work and the beliefs that are false. So I think it's for good, but it's good, and it's I think it's for the good of the people, but it's not very easy, and the times had very difficult times.
Your new movie, The Inner Circle, is about Stalinist projectionist. You actually knew Stalinist projectionist. How did you meet
him? I know him. He's alive.
He's still alive.
He's still alive. He lives in Moscow, and he's a Stalinist.
He's still a Stalinist.
He's a staunch Stalinist, and when you speak with him, it's very difficult to beat him because his stand is, Stalin was a great leader. Yes, he was severe. Yes, he put some people in prison. Yes, but he delivered goods. We had sausage, we had milk, we had bread. Every year there was some kind of, the prices went down, and now Gorbachev destroyed everything. We don't have anything, just words. And we don't have any sausage, we don't have food. And it's very difficult to speak with him about it because, that's true. Freedom is a great thing, but you cannot eat freedom and you cannot wear freedom when it's cold.
How did you meet Stalin's projectionist?
I met him, it was 25 years ago. I made a film that was about some gulags victims. And it was time of, middle 60s when it was Khrushchev's thaw, and Solzhenitsyn printed his book, that published his book, first book that made him so famous. And I made a film about victims of gulag. But it was a time when it was started already, the thaw, they decided to stop it, to stop the Stalinization, and my film was banned. So I went, I had to present my film to the censorship, and the projectionist in the censorship committee was this man with white hair, very thin, very lean, very agile. I asked him, listen, can you do me a favor? I cannot attend this meeting. Can you just snitch for me? Can you listen what the people are going to talk and then tell me? Because I'd like to know why they're going, what are the arguments to ban the film? And he did it for me. And I came later on, and he told me what he heard through the, through the partition as a projectionist, what they're talking about in the screening room. And then he dropped a couple of words like, they are not really bosses. Once I showed the film to the real master, and I asked him, who? And he said, Stalin. And, I just flip out, and I said, unbelievable, tell me more. Did you show really? And he told me about his life when he showed films to Stalin, and how he was brought up first. They took him from his bed at middle of the night, the KGB officers, and brought him to Kremlin, and he didn't know where even they're driving him, where he's going. He thought he's arrested, and they brought him to Kremlin, and they put him in the projection room and say, are you ready to show the films? And he didn't know even who he's going to show the film. And then he found out that it was Stalin, whose projectionist got sick.
I think your movie, in a way, tries to answer the question, why would somebody remain loyal to Stalin? Why would somebody be loyal to Stalin in the first place? And what effect would that loyalty have on their lives as they got older?
Yeah, you know, it's that was my main goal, to share with the world. There are several, of course, several goals why I wanted to make this film, because I knew this system pretty well. But I wanted to study this phenomena, because, you know, if Stalin was so bad, and it's very easy to show Stalin as a monster, and there were several films that showed, you know, Stalin or Mussolini or, you know, big dictators as bad people. That's easy. It's what is difficult is to understand why millions of people in different countries followed and cherished and, you know, worshiped these people, like, you know, like Stalin or like Mussolini or Perón in Argentina, or you can take even Khomeini. I mean, millions of Iranians hailed Khomeini as a character. We cannot say that they're all, you know, crazy people. It's a nation. The phenomenon of it's very, very interesting, sometimes frightening, but there is a kind of a seduction the idea that seduces and can seduce the whole nation. You're lucky in this country.
Does the story that you're telling hit close to home? And what I'm thinking of is that your father, I believe, got a writing award from Stalin, and I think it was Stalin who asked your father to write the national anthem.
My father participated, among other writers, in the competition for the best lyrics for the national anthem. And there were maybe 20 or 25 prominent Soviet writers that wrote different lyrics for that competition. And then it was a call from Stalin to my father, and I remember that time. And of course, you know, Stalin liked to call himself to shock people in the middle of the night. And my father was told that his texts, his lyrics, are better than other ones, and they won the competition. So he was brought to Kremlin, and in the middle of the night, it was a dinner with wine and grapes and oranges, all these goodies. It was 1943, during the war, and they brought him dead drunk at 5 o'clock in the morning. I don't remember that. My mother told me that when he came up, he just fell out of exhaustion and excitement that he saw this man.
So was he close to Stalin? Did he support Stalin?
No, close, you cannot say that, no. There were very few people who were really close to Stalin. No, he was one of these intellectuals that were believers that the Stalinist system is the best, and who was serving this system with wholeheartedly, I would say, till the moment that they, and all, of course, you shouldn't forget that the terror in this our country was on such extent that out of terror people could have done a lot of things. That's one of the reasons I wanted to show this film to Americans, because you don't know what does it mean, terror in your country. You're so lucky. Your system, of course, you have some fears, some anxieties, but never terror. State never terrorized your people, and you're happy. I envy you in that sense. My country had a lot of years of paranoia and, you know, and terror. I remember myself, you know, I'm not a very old man. I'm 54. But I remember till late 70s when I was talking on the phone, I was thinking always that someone is listening to me, and then my phone is bugged and I have to think what I'm talking about. And I have to really care about, I have to watch my mouth. Although maybe no one listened, but this paranoia was engraved in our consciousness of Soviet people. So during this time of terror, a lot of intellectuals trying like blind themselves and just serve the system in order to survive, and also maybe some kind of, there was of course a faith. And later, of course, now my father is alive, and he is lucky to see the disintegration of the society, of course, and but also he feels that part of his life was thrown away serving false ideals.
So now he feels those ideals were false?
Oh yeah, absolutely. He accepts it completely. He realizes that everything is false. And I remember last time I saw him this year, and he told me, "My God, I cannot imagine. I don't understand I cannot imagine that I was like this."
You've said that you were brainwashed when you were growing up, as in the 40s and 50s, as all children were then growing up in the Soviet Union. What did your parents tell you about Stalin, and what were your attitudes toward him when you were young?
You see, my parents didn't have to tell me anything about Stalin. It's like in your country, you don't speak about God very much. It just exists there, and that's it. in that sense, it's like a religious family. They make some rituals. If you pray before the food, you don't have to pray to Stalin, but you know that Stalin is always there, somewhere in Kremlin, thinking about you, and that's how it started in the school. Stalin is our father, our best friend, and our caretaker. The portraits of Stalin were every day in newspaper. The portraits of Stalin were, you know, on the walls everywhere.
Even in your home?
In my home, no. I wouldn't say, no, in my home, no. My house was still in, enough of, my house was, my home was quite intellectual, because my mother never was, I think, a Stalinist, and she was a Christian, and she was a religious woman, and she had to hide her convictions. But in the house, we didn't have this kind of officialdom. And
can I ask you to give us the English translation of your father's lyrics to the national anthem?
It's very. I don't remember them very well now, but it's basically "Long live the Union of Republics," something like this, and the Russia united all republics together, and there is lyrics, there are some lines talking about Stalin, and I think the reason why Stalin wanted to have a national anthem, because old national anthem was international. In this famous communist song, but this international didn't have Stalin's name, and he wanted to have a national anthem, of course, to have his name, and he didn't have to tell it to anyone who wrote the new national anthem. Every writer who wrote for competition mentioned Stalin in his text.
So how long was this?
Sorry?
I'm sorry. How long was the national anthem used?
This national anthem is still used. But the lyrics are different. I mean, the lyrics, they changed. They took Stalin's name out of it. But there were some lyrics about Stalin, like that Stalin raised our generations to be faithful to the country. Something like this. That was enough.
My guest is Soviet emigre film director Andrei Konchalovsky. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Soviet film director Andrei Konchalovsky, who has been making films in Hollywood since around 1979. His new film, The Inner Circle, is about Joseph Stalin's projectionist. Some of his other movies include Runaway Train and Shy People. Now, I know for a while your father was the head of the Writers' Union, which was the officially sanctioned writers' group in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
One journalist once referred to him as a conservative watchdog of the Soviet literary scene. I wonder how his status affected you when you started making movies. Did it open up doors for you? Did it give you the opportunity to film subjects or to film in certain places that might have been off limits to other directors?
No. That's, in that sense, it's just, I think, an opposite situation. You see, I have trouble. When I grew up and I started to study, I had a different, you know, it's a different generation. I was much more open to Western philosophy and Western ideology. We were already, you know, looking, we were children of de-Stalinization. And I had very strong confrontations with my father politically, because I was pro-Solzhenitsyn and I was pro-Pasternak, and I was kind of at house I was a rebellion, and my father was afraid that I'm going to be, you know, arrested as a dissident, because I was liberal and I was against communism, basically. First thing. And second thing, you see, to be a son of a man of politics in totalitarian state doesn't help you. Because especially when you want to express completely opposite thoughts, my first film that I made was banned for 2 years. My second film was banned for 24 years. and it was banned anyway. But there is kind of paradox or irony in the sense that when directors like me did a film that was banned, everyone said, you know, of course he dared to make this film because his father is such and such. It's just an opposite thing, because I did it because of my convictions, not at all because I wanted. It was a conflict.
How did the censorship system operate while you were making films in the Soviet Union?
Censorship operated on the level of ideology, and never on the level of the market. That means that when you submit the film, I wrote 25 scripts as a film writer and some of my films get banned also for several years as a script. So, but when you submit the script and the script is ideologically approved and the film is financed by the state, basically you can shoot whatever you want, because money is not a problem, wasn't a problem for the Soviet society. And the time and the labor, the cost of the film was not expensive. Therefore, you were allowed to make a film. And then no one watched what you're doing. Only when the film is finished, you present it to the film committee, and they suddenly see the film is not at all what was on the paper, and they can ban it. So about 40 or 50 films, and 40, about 40 films during that period were banned. But they were made, they were made. So,
what happened to your films that were banned? Did you get to keep a copy of them, or were they destroyed?
No, they were. They were banned and not destroyed. In Stalin time, some films were destroyed when they were banned. In the time of Brezhnev and Khrushchev, the banned films were kept on shelves, were shelved, and on one or two prints, and never shown. And when Perestroika came and Gorbachev and new generation of Soviet filmmakers came to power, there was a special commission that considered every film and released every film. So for example, the film that has been banned in 1967 were released in 1989 in Russia with big success. It's better late than never.
Well, let me ask you this. You moved, you left the Soviet Union to get more freedom in your life as well as in your movies. Yeah. But I'm wondering if you felt you found the filmmaking freedom that you wanted to in Hollywood, because Hollywood has its own set of restrictions. I mean, it's completely different kind of restrictions than the Soviet Union, but still there are limits on what you could do. And
of course, of course. Here is censorship of the market. Yes, it's different sort of restrictions, but you see, when I'm talking about freedom, I'm talking about freedom. It's not only freedom of creation, freedom to create your own life. What is important for the person finally to achieve the goal? It means to realize yourself according to how do you feel about yourself. I was lucky that I had a profession in my hands that I love, and the I can be useful. But to realize your life, it means to at least to have opportunity. In Soviet system, no one could realize his own life unless you're really a devoted communist. And most of the people were lying about their convictions just in order to build a career.
Let me ask you a question about your new movie, The Inner Circle, about Stalin's projectionist. Are you glad that you got to make this movie before the end of the Soviet Union, that you had the chance to go back while there still was a Soviet Union and make one last film?
I was in Russia this year for post-production. We have to put, you know, we have to record the music. And I came in August, and it was perfect timing. I came into Moscow just on the eve of the coup. On the 17th of August, I came to Moscow. On 18th of August, the tanks were on the streets, and I had to go to the studio. And I thought, my God, that's the end of the film. I will never be able to finish the film, and maybe they will keep me here. And I went to the studio. And it's unbelievable. 100 people, musicians, all came to the studio to make a recording because it was an American film. And because of their kind of a solidarity with the ideas that were in the film, and they came all 4 days of the coup. Every day they came, maybe too late, maybe sometimes they were late, but they came. It's like they were contribution. And meanwhile, behind the walls of the studio, the tanks are rumbling. And we had to stop recording sometimes because the studio was shaken. Unbelievable. And that was a very frightening experience.
Do you want to go back?
You see, I live between London and Los Angeles. I like to go to Moscow very often. I cannot go very often, but I'd like to go and see my family, my sister, my brother, see friends. I would like even to make a film sometimes, but not immediately because I have other plans. And I'm very happy that communism is over. And in that sense, I can tell you, it will be very, very deep hangover. It's a deep hangover for Russia now to come back from that kind of a nightmare.
Andrei Konchalovsky, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I hope you like the film.
Andrei Konchalovsky's new film is The Inner Circle. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.